It's the first day of school. You remember zipping up the last pocket on your children's new backpacks and sending them off to the classroom, but what you really won't forget is that feeling of absolute dread when they march back at the end of the day, backpacks overflowing with catalogs, flyers, and notices that mark the beginning of fundraising season. True, nobody really needs 50 yards of wrapping paper, a dozen boxes of chocolate bars, or 8 pounds of cookie dough, but many parents will buy it all anyhow. After all, in a time of tight budgets, many parents are willing to make up the difference if it means their kids can play sports or join the band, have textbooks, or even basic school supplies. But how much should a parent care or donate to another school? What happens when there are large economic disparities within a school district? Schools set in wealthy neighborhoods can raise a lot more money than schools in less fortunate neighborhoods. It's a set of issues that many school districts face and some have tackled amid plenty of controversy. Later on in the program, a conversation with classicist Barry Strauss, who's written a new history of a war that many regard as a myth, the fight for Troy. But first, school fundraising. We'd like to hear from you. How is this done where you live? Is it fair that some schools do much better than others? Is it fair to ask parents to donate to schools their kids do not attend? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Our first guest is Barbara Neff, a parent of two elementary school-aged children and a freelance writer. She's with us from the studios of Colorado Public Radio in Centennial, Colorado. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure.
And let me read a bit from your blog. I'm into my 8th year as the parent of a school kid. The first year or two, I took up the cause of school fundraising with vigor, even glee. I sold the wrapping paper, calendars, cookie dough, candy, and a wide array of trinkets and baubles to neighbors, family, coworkers, friends, strangers. Yep, my kid was top salesman just about every time. I hate school fundraisers. Why do you hate school fundraisers, Barbara?
You know, Neil, I would have to say at this point, I am a parent suffering fundraiser burnout.
How many times have you been through this? Obviously, it happens every year, I guess, and you've got 10 more years to go.
Yes, I have 10 years to go, and as I mentioned in my blog, I'm looking for a way out. I would say, on average, each of my children is asked to be involved in 3 or 4 fundraisers. So as a parent of two, you know, I have 8 fundraisers a year I'm expected to participate in.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, it's not so much that you object to donating to the school, it's these fundraisers.
Absolutely. I would never suggest that we close our checkbooks. The schools depend on the funds that come from fundraisers. I'm just saying it's a good idea gone bad.
So you've proposed the school fundraiser beg-off form, and describe it for us if you would.
Actually, it's tongue-in-cheek, although I have used it once, and I know a lot of other parents are considering using it. But basically, my form asks if it would be okay if a parent begs out of a particular fundraiser by simply writing out a check in the way of a donation, and then that way 100% of the funds go toward the cause, rather than the typical scenario where a fundraising company gets 50 to 80% of the funds and the school gets, you know, 20 to 50% of the funds.
Mm-hmm. I should point out it's a pretty funny tongue-in-cheek. Check all that apply. We do not need wrapping paper, cookie dough, candy, pastries, or more books. I do not have time to help my child promote this fundraiser. I'm too embarrassed to hit up friends and relatives once again for purchases. I mean, how many times can you hit your in-laws?
That's true. And what we've done in our family and actually among friends and neighbors and coworkers, we've called a truce, a fundraising truce. We have agreed among us not to hit up each other anymore. I'll support my school. You support yours. I won't ask you to buy popcorn if you won't ask me to buy candy.
So the next time you see a small child at your doorstep you don't know, it ought to be Halloween.
It better be.
Barbara Neff, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Again, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Barbara Neff is the parent of two children and a freelance writer, and she was with us today from the studios of Colorado Public Radio in Centennial, Colorado. School fundraisers have been around for ages, but many school districts are finding they need to rely more and more on fundraising to make ends meet. It drives a wider wedge, though, between the haves and the have-nots. Joining us now to talk about this is Tom Hutton. He's a staff attorney for the National School Boards Association, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you in the program.
Happy to join you.
How much of a concern is it that these fundraisers teenagers, Barbara Neff was having a good time with it, and it does get annoying after a while, but nevertheless, there is a real problem of equity, isn't there?
There can be, and I think where we've seen this play out more than any other place is in California, and it sort of has its roots with Proposition 13, which sort of really capped the ability of local school boards to raise local revenues, and you found parents stepping to the fore and saying, well, if our school board can't do it, we will do it. And we're not talking here about, you know, wrapping paper sales. We're talking very large-scale, sophisticated fundraising efforts that have happened in a lot of districts, much to the benefit of the schools, but it can raise these serious equity questions by masking the inability of some schools in the community not to have that kind of success.
There are also issues of... there seems to be a fundamental issue. What's the parents' responsibility? We're talking about public schools here. And what's the responsibility of the government?
The government's responsibility at every level of government, we would say, of course, is fundamental here. There's nothing more crucial to the future of the country and the economy than a successful public school system. But you find right now that school boards increasingly in many states are being put in the roles of suppliants, where the discretion to raise the money locally is being taken away, in part motivated by equity concerns, because over-reliance on property taxes leads to inequities as well.
Mm-hmm.
But when all the decision-making is at the federal and the state level, you have lawmakers whose focus isn't solely schools, and it's a competing priority with everything else, and this is played out with these local stretched budgets.
And in a lot of places where there have been cutbacks, this money goes not just for the curtain for the drama club. This goes to pay teachers' salaries, and that raises questions about, what are you going to do next year? You going to have another fundraiser?
Well, that's right. How do you sustain those efforts? And in fact, you have seen some school boards exercising greater oversight of these kinds of efforts, for example, by adopting policies that lay out what things can or cannot be supported with private money. And for example, we are not going to use privately raised funds to pay for staff or for buildings. They can go for band trips or whatever, but we're not going to obviate the need of government to step forward and meet the basic needs of education.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And this is Dania. Dania's with us from Newburgh in Oregon.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I was just concerned about the equality of it all, like you were talking. On our side of town here in Newburgh, we're on what's called the south side, and we are the only elementary that takes care of the entire south side of our town. And unfortunately, there are families that only have one person working and supporting three families, and we can't afford fundraisers. Well, myself, I can, but a lot of them can't, and I am involved in actually supporting these and directing these fundraisers a lot of times, and I just find it's very heartbreaking to see the people where they have five elementaries on the north side, they have helicopter rides afforded at their fairs. Their parents can afford everything, and their school benefits and their children's field trips are far superior.
And that she's not alone, that there are issues of fundamental fairness in a lot of school districts around the country.
Yeah, I would really be interested in hearing how in our county or our district, how we could, anyone's ideas on how we could, as parents and volunteers and coordinators, not make that fundraiser burnout, which none of us can afford practically anything to support these, but figure out how we can, throughout the district, get equal treatment and somehow maybe get a centralized effort going on.
Mm-hmm. Tom Hutton?
Yeah, I can toss out some ideas that some school boards have adopted. I mean, for one thing, about one-third of the school districts in the country now have foundations that support district-wide efforts, so they can account for those kinds of disparities. You've had some districts where they've adopted a mechanism by which any donation to the district, there's some percentage of it that will go into a central fund that can be used to sort of offset the disparities in the donations. There's also plenty of efforts to sort of connect schools with businesses in the community, maybe to connect PTAs from different school districts or different schools. If you have a very school that's very successful at fundraising and one that just inherently has challenges with it, you connect those two PTAs and the schools together, and they do efforts jointly.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand, Portland, Oregon, has a system which shares the money amongst the different schools.
That's right. I think that's the first time that the issue maybe. I think there was a school board member in the mid-90s who sort of came up with that idea because he saw the disparities in the district.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It's huge.
Dania, good luck. And what's your next fundraiser?
Actually, it's in a couple of days, and we have our kids running laps, and people throughout their in their personal lives, their connections, parents' work, etc., will donate per lap to how many laps these little guys can run. And it's an elementary school, so last year we got 18,000 out of the community and their outreaches. But hopefully this year we'll be able to support some great field trips. It's we're hoping.
And where do you hope to take the kids if they run a whole lot of laps?
Well, you know, the fifth graders unfortunately get a big chunk of it, and they actually do outdoor school for a week, and that's great. The third graders get some swim lessons. Second graders go to a wonderful play. We're not sure which one. Lots of different things. It's going to be great.
Good luck, Danya.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk with Bill. Bill's with us from San Antonio, Texas.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, well, you know, it was interesting that your commentator, the first lady that was on, you know, mm-hmm. asked the school how much money they got. And I'd done the same thing. I'm involved with my daughter's band program, and I'm also a retired military musician. I teach a lot of private lessons in the schools, and I do some work with the band programs on a class basis. And so a lot of my pay comes from the fundraisers, because that's what they don't have any school district money to pay outside tutors. So you know, when the band gets done with their fundraiser, they can bring me in to mm-hmm. help the kids every week with their sectionals. And my daughter's band director told me they only get 40% of the cash that's brought in. And I said, you know, can I just write you guys a check? Because if I was going to spend $40 or $50 on the fundraiser, I'd rather just give it to them.
Yeah.
Because the stuff, when you look at the stuff in the catalogs, the quality's not very good, and there's nothing I'm really interested in buying anyway. I'd just rather have the kids get the money.
All right, Bill. What's the best thing you ever bought from one of these catalogs?
Well, some plastic salad tongs.
I'm sure those came in handy.
Well, actually, it's a set that goes, you know, you get one for each hand, and you can actually toss the salad rather than a set of tongs that's got a hinge on it. And that was actually something that was reasonable. I think it cost us about $6, and they go in the dishwasher pretty well. But most of the stuff, you know, it's worse than Walmart. So,
Bill, good luck. Thanks very much for the call.
All right. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking about school fundraisers. Are they fair? And what's too much to ask of parents? I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about school fundraising, the cookies, candy bars, wrapping paper, and other trinkets sold by students to raise money for their schools. In wealthy neighborhoods, students can raise a lot more money than those in less fortunate areas. Is that fair? Our guest is Tom Hutton, a staff attorney for the National School Boards Association. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Is it fair that some schools do better? Is it fair to ask parents to give to schools their kids don't attend? Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Several school districts have tried to address some of the inequities in school fundraising and have not always been met with enthusiasm. Joining us now to talk about one district experience is John Dacey. He's CEO of Prince George's County Public Schools in Maryland, formerly superintendent of the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District in California, and he's with us today from the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York City. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you very much.
Now, when you were head of schools in Santa Monica, you implemented a measure that would make funds more equitably distributed across the district. Why was that necessary?
There were enormous disparities in fundraising amongst various parts of the school community on a per-pupil basis. And again, the context was California, so fundraising played a major role in some of the very necessary things. So on a per-pupil basis, you would have one school who could raise $32 over the course of a year in fundraising per pupil, and another school $1,003 per pupil. And when you add that up, that's a fairly broad disparity.
So how did you try to address it?
We proposed a policy that was eventually adopted after a long series of public discussion and good but very difficult debate. That took a percentage of all fundraising at every single site, pooled it, and redistributed it based on a student-weighted formula that took into account factors of impact such as poverty and the like.
And as I understand it, you mentioned difficult debate. There was a lot of controversy.
There was. A lot of it dealt with some of the comments that you were talking about in the previous section, the difference between fairness and equity, and the ability for one school to be focused just on one school and the parents of that school versus an entire school system.
And I'm sure you've heard this comment before. I want my money to go to the school my kid attends as to those other schools. That's why I pay taxes.
Correct. And we heard that a lot and had to talk that piece through. And we shaped the conversation around the issue of community. While there are many schools, it is one community. And all of our youth actually graduate from one community and participate in our democracy. And the fundamental notion is that every student gets, in my opinion, the right to the same quality of educational experience, no matter what their geography, especially when we're responsible for the totality of one school district.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come up with that 15% formula?
Well, that was the number that we proposed and enacted, so that 15% of everything that was raised at a school site over the course of a year was then pooled and then redistributed on a formula based on impact. And we looked over roughly the percentage of a total budget in a school that was supplemented by fundraising. Because in California, as was mentioned earlier, we have enormous impact on the ability to raise funds. So music and library books and furniture and staff and support staff, and the list goes on, are frequently supported by the incredible generosity of parents.
And how much did this formula and this proposal reduce the differential between the better-off schools and the poorer ones?
We reduced the differential the first year after we proposed it by a fairly significant margin. But I think the more important piece of data was the real concern after we implemented it, that actually district-wide fundraising would decrease, when in fact it actually increased. Well, I think the community had a difficult but very good debate. Again, in the end, it was a very much a conversation about community, one that I was quite proud of, albeit it was tough.
Let's get some more listeners involved in the conversation. Oh, by the way, are you doing the same thing now in Prince George's County, Maryland?
We're not with fundraising. It's certainly the general support from finance for per pupil is much higher in Maryland. But we are with our schools of greatest need with local dollars to support the same issue, only it is with the ability to do it with general funds.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's get Lorraine on the line. Lorraine's calling us from Anchorage in Alaska.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I agree with this caller and the plan that he implemented with the formula for division of funds from fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, if people have the mentality that they want the money to go to my school, then they perhaps need to be in a private school. And public education is just that. I don't agree with the fundraising at all in general. I think the public needs to pay for education because we are a community, even people that don't have children, no matter where their schools go. But if we are going to do fundraising, it does need to be distributed equally among the schools and within that school district.
Well, then you're going to get districts that are wealthier than other districts. How far do you take this, Lorraine?
Well, I don't believe in fundraising for schools. I think PTAs in that respect have done more harm for schools and masking the situation of how much money a school needs to really operate. And I think we're just catching up with ourselves now.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally would not have any fundraising. I think that the taxpayers need to pay for public education.
Tom Hutton, what do you think?
I certainly agree that the taxpayer support for public education is not where it should be. Half the states are facing lawsuits right now over their state financing system, and Congress is poised to level fund education this year and to conveniently wait until after the election to do that. But I also I don't want to dismiss out of hand the notion that it's great to tap that kind of level parental support of parental support and enthusiasm, which includes check writing. I think you will find a lot of communities that say, we'd love for Congress to fully fund No Child Left Behind in IDEA, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. Meanwhile, my kid's in school now.
Mm-hmm. John Deasy.
Yes.
What do you think?
I think the ideal, of course, is to have states and the federal government actually rise to the expectation that we would hope, and that is to fund a high-quality education. The reality is it doesn't happen. It's not likely to happen in the future. My children and everybody else's is in school at the moment, so I completely understand that we want the best for our child. I think the dilemma becomes, do we want the best for every child in the community of schools that we work in? And I think that is one that we need to approximate a conversation about community and equity, not necessarily equality.
Lorraine, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Richard in Gilbert, Arizona. My question is simple. Why do we need all these fundraisers? When I was a kid in school in the 70s, we had few extracurricular activities. My parents took me to museums, paid for swimming lessons, and provided the outside entertainment that school officials think they need to offer. Just stick to the fundamentals of education. I earned a PhD, and I'm doing just fine, and not once did I have to participate in a fundraiser as a child. We're creating problems rather than just educating our children. Does he have a point, Tom Hutton?
It's a good point, but it ignores a lot of things, I think. I mean, I think we have an expectation in this country that the whole school experience is not just academic, and that our definition of academic is very broad. I mean, the arts are part of a well-rounded education. These activities mm-hmm. that kids engage in are not frills. They are fundamental to an education. The other thing is many of the things that schools do in this country that are not necessarily performed by schools in other countries are required by federal law. I mean, we use the public schools in this country as sort of a substitute healthcare system in a lot of ways. Those kinds of things are very expensive, and in this country, it appears in the school budget. It doesn't mean that we're spending more as a country than other countries do, but it's in the school budget here.
Certainly a supplementary nutritional system for kids, too.
Exactly right.
Yes, sir. Let's get another caller on the line. This is James. James is with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, James.
My kids just recently had a fundraiser program at their elementary to raise money for their playground equipment. Mm-hmm. And we got the catalog home, and with a flyer, it said that if each kid were to sell 10 items, they've got their own special pizza party with our local or our area professional football team mascot during school hours. So I took exception to it because I felt like, well, what about the kids who aren't in the position to sell 10 items, and they're stuck in the class while the other kids go to the cafeteria and have a party with Jackson DeVille, you know? Mm-hmm. So I wrote a letter to our PTA saying my kids wouldn't participate in this program, and, you know, I just felt like that a lot of these kids already know that they're not in that position to, or financially not in a good position. I think it just made them feel even worse mm-hmm. by not being mm-hmm. able to go participate in this party.
John Dacey, do issues like that come up where you're in charge, Prince George's County?
They do come up. I think the guideline is, and I think this gentleman makes an incredibly important point, and that is actually incentivizing the issue, which is dividing, is yet another issue that we have to wrestle with.
Hello?
Yeah, you know, I'm all for the having the party, but I think they should say this is how much money we need to raise, and if one kid can just buy one item, then he feels like he participated mm-hmm. in buying that, helping to buy for the gym, you know?
All right, James, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Mm, thank you.
Here's an email from Tom in Berkeley. I've been the treasurer for the Rosa Parks PTA in Berkeley for 3 years and a parent at the school for my sixth year. Last year, we decided to try something radical, drop the usual product sale fundraiser, and just ask for the money. The result is we earned more than we did selling the stuff with a lot less effort. We did encourage families to get their extended family, friends, and companies to contribute. This has now replaced the sales stuff, though we still do silent auctions, fairs, etc., to fund our activities. So are more schools, Tom Hutton, coming up with ideas like that?
I think there's a lot of outside-the-box thinking on the part of schools and school boards and school communities. It's interesting, though, a lot of the other ideas, each of them has an attendant controversy, just as this one does. Mm-hmm. I mean, locating a cell phone on the school to get that money, well, some people raise health risks. The commercialization of schools brings in a lot of money, mm-hmm. but the vending machines,
microwave towers,
and advertising through Channel One, or they've now got this bus radio program. These are all things that can bring funds into the school, but they all have a degree of controversy. Even renting the school facility to churches on the weekend in some communities is controversial, although it's very widespread, but that brings more of money into the school through alternate means.
John Dacey, if you would give us some guidance, I mean, how much did outside money, fundraising money, contribute to your budget in California? How much does it in Maryland?
So in California, it contributed a substantial sum of money. So we were talking about north of 10% in the annual operating budget of an individual school. In Maryland, it is considerably less, although the issue of scale and economic impact is much larger in the community I have.
Because of the nature of the community you're in.
That's correct. So I think the question becomes, how do we resolve these issues in a way where you have the least amount of these types of impacts? And for me, I think the issue is a foundation that supports the basic mission of the school, whose primary purpose is to do this fundraising, and then it's left with the school to deal with the issue of equitable distribution of those funds.
Mm-hmm. And are there foundations in Prince George's County?
There are, and there were very active foundations in my school district in California.
We're talking about fundraising for public schools and equity. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And let's get Peggy on the line. Peggy's calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Peggy.
Hi. Well, I have a couple objections to the fundraisers. My kids have been in school for about 10 years, so I have some experience with it. The first is, I'm not sure all parents realize how aggressive it is. The kids are frequently collected into an assembly and given a kind of pep talk by a wrapping paper representative or, you know, whatever. I think that's very unfair. I think your children are being solicited without any control. The kids come home, you say, I'm not buying this wrapping paper, and they dissolve into tears. So you buy wrapping paper. It seems like extortion to me, anyway.
There is, John Tacey, an element of extortion. You know, if you don't do it, your kid's not going to be on that list.
That's right. They don't get the ice cream party.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, everyone in the class has to participate, or there's almost a penalty. The second problem I have with it, at least within our school district, is the funds are restricted. You can't spend it on teacher salaries, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So the schools are limited in what they can spend it in. And I know at our particular school, they seem to have run out of things they can spend it on. The things they're spending it on are almost trivial. They certainly don't improve instructional time or anything like that. In fact, in many ways, they take away from it because they're creating an activity that, you know, the kids go off to. And that's debatable.
Mm-hmm.
But
Well, I just want to give John Daisy a chance
sure.
to respond.
I actually welcome the comments because I think they're important. One is I very much agree with the notion that we've got to be extremely careful about asking our youth to participate in the act of the fundraising. Asking parents to be involved in that, direct donation, using a foundation is a very different matter. Second of all, and for all the reasons that she has so eloquently spoken about, the second issue is we have been, and I couldn't agree more, you've got to be incredibly careful in what you spend it on. It needs to be working most directly in helping youth achieve very high levels of proficiency and achievement in school. So the fact that we're not even sure how to spend it in and of itself would merit the debate long before you raise the money.
Right. Well, I know several fundraisers, they haven't even had a goal. The aim is to raise money. And there seems to be a culture within the schools, and not just the schools my children go to, but many, that more is better. And many, many schools have very large bank accounts that are just sort of sitting there. And they do use them, year after year, but they have a holding tank of money.
You might suggest they send the interest to Prince George's County, Maryland.
It just seems crazy to me. So, well, thank you very much.
All right. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to ask you both, Tom Hutton, do you see, as you say, is this likely to change anytime soon? Is this going to, these issues still going to be developing, or are more schools going to be organizing foundations like John Daisy's?
I think you'll see all of these, this whole menu of alternative ways of bringing in money continue to increase, particularly as long as, you know, we don't have the political will to get at the issues of the gap between the expectations we have of our schools and what the financing system is set in place to do. That doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate issues, for example, about are we fundraising for its own sake, but I think the trend is likely to continue given the funding trends mm-hmm. in Congress and in state capitals.
And political will, you've been on both sides of that, John Daisy.
Yeah, I actually agree with everything he just said with two important points. One is, I think the issue is that the issue of equity is going to continue to loom large and become primary. And then I think the second point is the very, very careful notion of how we actually involve our youth in the actual act of fundraising needs to be determined before we even touch it.
A generation of salesmen.
That's what we would like to avoid.
John Daisy, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
John Dacey, CEO of Prince George's County Public Schools. He joined us today from the studios at Carnegie Hall in New York City. Tom Hutton was with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Nick.
Tom Hutton is a staff attorney for the National School Boards Association. When we come back from a short break, the real story of Paris, Helen, the Wrath of Achilles, and the Trojan Horse, and we'll remember an American treasure. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.